an interview with Tim Benjamin. Thank you very much indeed for agreeing to talk to the Hercules Project about your dramatic work, Heracles.
You're welcome. We were sat down after a previous Todmorden and Choral Society concert of St. Paul by Mendelssohn, and now I was talking to Emma Stafford, the senior lecturer, about her specialist subject of Heracles, and I said, well, someone should write an oratorio about Heracles. So then that just post-concert euphoric thing to say, but actually it stuck, and then I started talking to Anthony Brannick, who's the music director of the Choral Society. How about actually doing it, and why doesn't the Choral Society commission it? But that would be quite a big thing to do. Quite an important thing to do as well, I think, even from a national perspective, that a well-established choral society actually commissions a new piece and commits to putting it on, and that's a major undertaking. And it requires money, yes, but it also requires organisation, it requires lots of goodwill and a professional soloist to come in, and also other players to augment the orchestra. And it's a big thing and it's an important thing, and it's very valuable that they've done that, I think. And obviously I'm very grateful to be the person to have written the music.
What was it in particular, other than Emma's glowing reports of Hercules, that attracted you to that hero in particular?
Well, I'm attracted to all kinds of characters, I think, for the operas that I've done, which has been one of my main pieces of bodies of work. I've 10 operas, funnily enough. Some of them are quite short, sort of 40 minutes, and some of them full-length, two-hour things. And so I'm generally attracted to people and situations. Funnily enough, in this Heracles project, there wasn't a particular character, really, to latch onto. Neither was there a particular situation to latch onto, so it's unusual in that way. But what was attractive, one of my favourite oratorios is Oedipus Rex by Stravinsky, and I thought that actually there would be something about Heracles which was similar in that it could be presented in a similar kind of way, telling a classical story with a narrator, with soloists and with a chorus, and the chorus perhaps also performing to some extent the function of a Greek chorus in a Greek drama. So those were some of the things that attracted me to it. You know, you've got the layman's idea of who Hercules or Heracles is, the labours obviously being the thing that everyone thinks they know, although trying to name all of them is a challenge. But I didn't really want to do labours because I thought that would be a bit sort of an obvious idea, and there aren't many ways to do it. What do? You just kind of go through all of them and present one after the other, and it becomes a little bit tedious. Yes. We spent quite a long time, we being Emma and I, but also my fellow collaborator on the text is a man called Anthony Peter, who is a distinguished man of letters, with whom I've collaborated before on text for operas. We looked around for some time for a suitable aspect of the Heracles discourse or corpus which we could latch onto and create a situation or a text out of. One of the things we chose early on was to try and look at the idea of Hercules in the modern era, or what it means today, through goods being branded Hercules, through football teams, through what else, whether military aircraft, ships, all sorts of things that are named Hercules. And that's just a remarkable thing, that a legend which is many, many thousands of years old, and it's still in popular circulation. And there are very, very few other things which have the same sort of modern currency. There's Christ, I suppose, but that's actually more modern than Hercules. There's perhaps things like Buddha, who could be perhaps as ancient, like my theology expertise is not great enough to know. But certainly it's unusual, and that was one aspect we were looking at. That didn't actually come to anything, but it is an interesting journey nonetheless. What we eventually settled on was, so that I anticipate your next question.
That's okay, yes. How would you come to settle on the story of Hercules' choice then?
Well, we looked at the choice as another big area which we could consider as suitable, and that seemed to be much more interesting from my usual perspective, because you have the idea of virtue and vice, opposites and being pulled in one way or the other, and a simple kind of setup of having to make a choice. That had potential. But trying to make a story or a long 90-minute thing out of really just a moment, even though it's a struggle, an internal struggle and all of that, it's really just a moment. That was difficult. So then Emma sent us Well, Emma had sent us lots of things to read, but one of the things she sent us was the Discourses on Kingship by Leo Chrysostom. And in particular his take on the choice, which is just slightly different to the usual version. The usual version being where virtue is a harder path to take and vice is the easy, the slippery slope that you fall down, which is the sort of conventional way of looking at these things, where to be virtuous is the harder path but the more worthy path to take. Chrysostom took a different approach. He took virtue to be royalty and vice to be tyranny, two ways in which one could rule. So the Emperor Trajan was the person that Leo Chrysostom was addressing in these discourses, trying to show the emperor two ways in which he could rule. I mean, basically he's a Roman emperor, so he's going to be a dictator of some sort, certainly a totalitarian ruler of some sort. But it presented him with royalty on the one hand, tyranny on the other. So that's sort of a noble versus a brutal ruler. And he said, actually, that the royalty or the virtuous way is the easy way, and the tyrannous way, the treacherous way, is the harder way. And it was a hard path, and it was a treacherous path, and there were risks. So that, actually, then turning that on its head, made it attractive. But also, Leo Chrysostom portrays it as a journey that a young Heracles, a boy, has to take and is sent on by Zeus to be challenged to face both royalty and tyranny and see for himself what they're like. So we've got a dramatic story, we've got a story we can tell, which is what I like to have when I'm writing a piece of this size. And it also threw up lots of very attractive things, such as portraying royalty and tyranny as two titans, two women, one a soprano as royalty and one a mezzo-soprano tyranny, to portray Heracles as a boy, so we could have a treble, which is very nice to write for, and other characters, Zeus, obviously, to set the challenge as a base, and also Hermes, who is the one that takes the young Heracles away to this mountainous place where he has to make the choice. So we have a tenor, a dramatic, over-the-top tenor, which is ideal for Hermes to be this sort of literally mercurial character. So we ended up with a very attractive story, which we then adapted. We also have a narrator, who we said is Time herself, who actually tells the story, really, and then the characters get involved, explaining what they're doing, and then we have the chorus portraying both a sort of commentary act, but also taking on different roles, such as the subject of royalty and tyranny, literally how they feel being ruled in those ways. So we've now got a dramatic setup which we can create a whole 90-minute piece out of.
You've made some alterations to the story, some adaptations, so I thought we might talk about those for a little bit. I wanted to ask, the geographic location in the Dio Chrysostom is quite well described, but it's limited to the mountain itself, and it's not given an actual real-world location as such. So why did you choose to have a real-world location?
Well, I thought it had to be somewhere. In the Dio Chrysostom, yes, it's not really clear where it might be. Really, he just describes two peaks of the same mountain. The idea, I think, is that it's somewhere within the known world of ancient Greece, or perhaps it doesn't seem to be somewhere on the top of, say, Mount Olympus. It's definitely a distance away from that. It's clearly not Olympus, and it's clearly not local to Thebes, where Heracles is picked up from. So it's some distance away, and just for the sake of having a look, where is there a suitable mountain where people wouldn't really go? So it wants to be remote enough so that the average person doesn't go up there. And I suppose the closest high mountains where people don't go are the Alps. And I thought, well, that's one possibility, and that's within the known world of the time. But actually, I thought, well, really, we wanted to have the journey that he goes to be a major scene within the piece. And describing him flying over northern Italy wasn't particularly interesting. So we thought, well, why not go the whole hog and have this mountain in the Himalayas, or perhaps the Karakoram, somewhere out right over there, the highest possible mountains. And there we can describe the journey, and we can have Hermes showing Heracles three object lessons in how or how not to rule. So he shows him three collapsed civilizations of the distant past. One is a fishing community, or more than that, a kingdom, an empire that's based around the sea that collapses as the result of a tsunami or a natural disaster which they fail to prepare for, despite being warned about it. Then another is really a sort of Mongol horde that collapses as a result of constant war. And then finally, it's a civilization that's really in the foothills of the Himalayas or the Karakoram, which is the Indus Valley civilization, which is a less well-known, I think, famous dead civilization, but certainly a very fascinating one.
Which goes some way towards explaining why you chose the ones that you did.
Yes, because that was a clear journey as well, going first out over the Mediterranean, seeing the Minoans, that's who we chose for that. And then flying over the steppes of Central Asia to see this horde of horse warriors. And then, yeah, finally in the foothills of the high mountains.
If someone were to make a link between the collapse of Minoan civilization, which followed the eruption of Theora Santorini and the tsunami, with Plato's Atlantis, which also suffers a natural disaster and sinks below the waves, but he has it directly as a comment on the system of government, would you say that's a justified reading of your inclusion of the Minoans?
Well, so the reason we include them is because it suited the route they were taking, but it also suits the purpose of showing Heracles not models of government as such, as perhaps Plato is getting at, but certainly examples of kings that have failed, rather than systems of government, if you see what I mean. So in our reading of the Minoans, the king is warned by the wise men that when the sea retreats, you have to take evasive action, and the warnings are ignored. And so that's, I suppose, the lesson to be drawn from that about how to be a king is, well, listen to the elders, to the wise people, and listen to your council, because perhaps they might have something to say. It's purely coincidental that we're doing this at a time where, perhaps as never before, leaders have been scrutinised, their council and their actions. So it's quite timely, which is nice to have that.
And there's a slight tie back to the Oedipus with
wise
men, followers, and your council. The other thing I wanted to ask was, in most versions of the choice story, Hercules chooses the right path, or the story's left at the point when he's about to make a choice, and the reader is aware of he's going to choose the right thing. So how have you dealt with Hercules making his choice, and why?
Zeus expects Hercules to choose royalty, in the same way that Dio Chrysostom expected Trajan to choose royalty as being the better path. But looking at it, I felt quite strongly that the two options presented were really two sides of the same coin, that coin being essentially totalitarian rule, even shall we say fascist rule. So you could say that perhaps he's given the choice of ruling like Hitler or ruling like Stalin. So two types of dictator who approach things from different ways but end up with an equally awful result. So I portrayed royalty actually as being much more sort of terrifying than you might think. So it's not just a sort of a peaceful, wonderful Sylvian forest type of place, but it's actually incredibly austere, and peace is achieved through having very rigorous law which everyone obeys at all times, so no possibility of self-expression or anything like that, or self-determination. Similarly with tyranny, it's much easier to imagine how that's unpleasant, but we've shown it as people responding to a tyrannical leader through expressions of extreme self-interest, so constantly trying to steal and get one up on each other, really following the example of the ruler, the tyrant, who's stabbed everyone's back and is on top of this big pile of bodies, I suppose. So really, Zeus is expecting Heracles to rule in the style of royalty, but Heracles chooses actually neither of these choices, and decides that the whole town is a fraud, and that humans should be able to self-determine their future, and there should be no more destiny, there should be no more fate, there should be no more meddling gods, and that's it. So it ends in a type of a Götterdämmerung, I suppose. Zeus is angry and sends the Titans, royalty and tyranny, to Hades. He banishes Hermes, goes off in a huff himself, I suppose, and Heracles is left to go and wander forever in the world of men as an immortal, but to try and help mortals find their own future. Which is, I think, quite a nice message for the piece to have, for people to take. It's quite clear, it's a good message, and yeah, we shall see if they pick up on it. Hopefully they will.
You've said quite a lot so far, actually, about the importance of the research to the compositional process. Is there anything else you'd like to add on that front?
Well, for me, actually, creating the text and the story is really a fundamental part of the composing process. We've been talking about characters, you know, Zeus, Hermes, Hercules and so on. Well, already there you're setting out who the voices are going to be within the piece. And when you're writing the text and you say, well, here we have Zeus singing or speaking, and here we have the chorus, you're giving the piece a structure already. So right from the very beginning, that is part of the composing process. So although you haven't written a single note yet, you've actually already written a large part of the piece through this creation of the text. I place quite a lot of importance on that, and so it is frustrating for collaborators who are writing the text. You think they can write a text and hand it over to the composer and then I can write music, but I don't work like that. I actually compose whilst creating the text and even finding the story. It's all part of it.
So the process of bringing the musical score and the libretto together then is quite complex.
Yes. Yeah, well, certainly I'm already creating music from the beginning. So let's imagine, for example, when creating the text, I might decide, well, I did decide that near the end it would be very good to have the quartet of soloists, so Zeus, Hermes and the two Titans, singing together. So you've got to divide the text in a way so that you can achieve that, and you can achieve it at a sort of dramatic moment. So they're intertwined, music and libretto, very much.
Right, no, because usually it's a one way or the other kind of process.
You know, other people write in different ways. And actually, within the text itself, there's a lot of music, the rhythm of the words and the alliteration. And I'm always quite clear that I don't like rhymes within a text, because then that really locks in what you have to do in the music to follow the rhymes. And it's quite hard to hear rhymes sometimes, unless the tune is very, very simple and straightforward. So I'm more of a fan of alliteration, which is, I suppose that's a rhyme at the beginning of words rather than at the end of words, because that's much more effective when adding singing to text.
You mentioned Stravinsky's Oedipus earlier, but that's not a direct musical influence on this rather than a structural one. So was there any particular piece or pieces of music or musical style that influenced this work?
I would say that actually Oedipus Rex is a musical influence on it, I think. He has this pattern which comes back time and again within that piece. It's often heard on timpani. Bum, 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 bum. He has that quite a lot. I have a similar sort of motif which comes back, which we derived from variations, different ways of pronouncing the name Heracles. So you have a long and two short two longs, you have the emphasis at the beginning, at the end. So we actually worked out a rhythm comprised of all the different ways of saying it. And it's a short and quite catchy rhythm. That pervades the whole piece. Yeah, it's heard right at the beginning, it's a great big chorus which is constantly made up of this rhythm. And it really lodges in your head, actually, and sticks there quite powerfully. So yeah, sort of harmonic world of Stravinsky is one which I like a lot. So yeah, I would say that there is quite a musical influence from that. My other favourite oratorio is Elgar's The Dream of Giontius. I'm not sure how that has such a musical influence. It's not totally alien to the piece, but it's an interesting one to compare, because there you have a soul, or a man who dies and becomes a soul, and then he's taken on a journey past purgatory, past the gates of hell, and then he arrives in heaven and he sees God just for a fleeting moment, before he goes and whiles away his days sitting on a cloud. That's very, very similar to the journey that Heracles goes on. He's taken on a journey, he goes not past the gates of hell, but he goes through the land of tyranny. And in the Elgar piece, he has the chorus as a demonic chorus, doing all these sort of fantastic sounds and this energy and this demonic intensity. Well, I've done a very similar thing with the awful people that live in the land of tyranny. And I think that's something that the chorus hopefully find. I think they are finding it a lot of fun, pretending to be these avaricious people, snatching and stealing and murdering, all that. So it has been quite an influence, I suppose, The Dream of Giontius. And it's got some very, very nice, beautiful choruses in that as well, and I've tried to perhaps emulate that a bit, having these very nice choruses for people to sing.
You've been quite enthusiastic about that section of the work. Is that your favourite, or is there another favourite section that you have, and if so, why?
I've got quite a few favourite sections, actually. There's a bit where Hermes sings. It's actually right at the end of the first half, after they've left the realm of royalty, and the music turns from this moment of relief, of rest, from having left this very austere place, and they're sitting down just on a rock by a river, and relaxing, and the music goes from that sort of moment of relaxation, takes a much more sinister turn to reach the end of the first half, before in the second half reaching the gates of tyranny. And that transition, it's just a small musical moment, but that's probably one of my favourite bits. But there's some lovely bits that the treble sings, which I like. Those are particularly special moments. There is one other bit which is worth pointing out. There is a chorus which comes back twice, at the beginning and at the end, where we've taken the text of a Homeric hymn, and that works very nicely. Emma's translation, which we've bowdlerised a bit.
Wonderful. So not only a story from thousands of years ago, but an actual piece of work as which would have been sung originally. So that's really good to have a modern version, which is nice. Given that there are so many favourite pieces, was there anything that was particularly challenging as a section, as far as composing it was concerned, and if so, why?
No, there weren't really too many challenging bits to it. It composed itself quite well. I think that when you spend so much time on a text, actually writing the music is reasonably straightforward. I mean, there are some technical challenges to face. For example, if you are writing for a treble, along with a large symphony orchestra, you don't want to drown him out. Got to be sensitive to the voice, and also trying to make royalty and tyranny, you know, very different characters as well. So I've picked up a few things there. I mean, royalty, she's a soprano, and it's an incredibly high part as well. It's terrifying, the characterization of it, I think. But then so is tyranny. She's also got to be terrifying, but terrifying in a different way. She sings really quite low down in her range, but it's this very baroque, ornate way of singing, which is very indulgent as well. She's quite scary from a different sort of way, I think.
No, I'm really interested to hear it now. Thank you. I've run through my questions, but was there anything else that you felt you wanted to explain or clarify about the work?
Using a narrator, I think, is an important point, because that allows us to tell the story without the encumbrance of any music, and then we can actually dwell in the music on really exploring the meaning of what's going on, characterising characters, commenting on the action. So the narrator is a pretty key part to that as well, I think.
Which you'd said would come about sort of partly from the Stravinsky and partly from the Dio, because he has a narrator.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.